the heart of me. So deep in my heart, you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist?
Hello. That sounds almost like the anthem for the countries we'll be talking about today. That they've got the United States under their skin. It is Monday, March the 7th, here on Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we spend the entire hour doing some pretty wonderful discussions. I say wonderful because it's very rare that you basically you have a person of this caliber so familiar with a part of the world. That you don't get access to all the time. And so this program was a suggestion from a listener, Louis Bedrock, and I followed through, and I am so delighted. Our guest is William Blum. Hello, Bill. Are you there?
Hi.
Great. So let me formally introduce you. William Blum is one of the United States' leading non-mainstream experts on American foreign policy. He left the State Department in 1967, abandoning his aspiration of becoming a Foreign Service officer because of his opposition to what the U.S. was doing in Vietnam. He then became a founder and editor of the Washington Free Press, the first alternative newspaper in the capital. He has been a freelance journalist in the United States, Europe, and South America, and his stay in Chile in 1972-73, writing about the Allende government's socialist experiment and then its tragic overthrow in a CIA-designed coup, instilled in him a personal involvement and an even more heightened interest in what his government was doing in various corners of the world. He currently sends out a monthly internet newsletter, The Anti-Empire Report. He's written three books. I'm holding in my hands the latest, which will be the source of our discussion today. The other two were Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, and Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower. Our discussions are going to be framed by his current book, his most recently published book, and that is literally brand new. You want to go get a copy. It's titled America's Deadliest Export, Democracy: The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. So I'm so grateful that you're with us today, because this is a subject that the average layperson doesn't have that much authenticated information to go on. So thank you again for being with us.
My pleasure, you three.
Well, that's much of what you cite the U.S. foreign policy, current foreign policy, as being rooted in post-World War II. What was it about that time, at the end of World War II, that shaped U.S. foreign policy? And what was it before? What did it become after World War II?
Well, after the Second World War, the U.K., in effect, abandoned its empire, and it gave it over to the U.S., and the U.S. was already in that mood to be an empire. In fact, it was suggested that the U.S. empire began with the first killing of by the first American settler of the first Indian, which began the expansion west, and then we haven't stopped ever since. Once we crossed the continent, we attacked Mexico and so on. The empire has been in the making for centuries, and it's now at its peak. the most powerful force ever. And the dissolution of the Soviet Union about 12 years ago gave it added impetus. The last remaining possible barrier to world empire had retired. And now the U.S. still views Russia and China as the only two possible barriers to further expansion of the empire, and that's why their policies towards those two nations are often rather hostile.
Is empire, the way you use it, a political term, or is it a military term?
Well, it's both. It's been created and expanded by the use of military force. But the purpose is political and ideological. The leaders of our empire really believe their own propaganda that America is God's gift to humanity, and it's our obligation to spread this marvelous gift as far as and as wide as we can, and that's what we do. And they look to impose their philosophy and their capitalist system wherever they go and wherever they establish a base. And we have hundreds and hundreds of bases all over the world right now.
I want to ask a devil's advocate kind of question, but isn't this typical, in a way, of all historical periods? We find in any particular historical period that one examines, you find the quest for dominance, and I mean total dominance, by one group or the other, by one country or the other, one faith or the other, people seeking not just control, but total control, and use military force, even in the quest in the name of God, as the Crusades did, sweeping all through Europe, or as the Moors did. Is the United States, therefore, any different from the period, any period that we've examined in history in terms of how groups or countries jostle for the right to be dominant?
Well, I view the world, and my writing reflects this, I view it from a moral point of view, not from a power point of view. I'm concerned about making a better world. As we all know, there's just too much horror and suffering and violence every day in every part of the world. And humanity can scarcely continue in this fashion for much longer. And besides the effect upon the environment, which by itself is reason enough to stop it. So I'm concerned with stopping this, even if it may be historically normal and common, that doesn't change anything. We have to put an end to this. If the environment alone, we have to stop this. The money we spend and on war could pay for everything that this society and the world needs. You know, if we didn't spend this money on war and empire, we should offer our citizens, everybody, completely free medical care forever, completely free education, all the way up through medical school. We could do everything which is needed for the environment. There's no limit to what we could do if we just would stop waging war. And that's what motivates my writing. I'm not concerned about whether we're acting in the same way as previous empires did or not. We have to deal with what we have now.
Actually, you make that very point in the book, and you reference the Holocaust in making that very point. The United States, you say, very early on in the book, endeavored to overthrow more than 50 foreign governments, most of which were democratically elected, grossly interfered in democratic elections in at least 30 countries, attempted to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders, dropped bombs on the people of more than 30 countries, attempted to suppress a populist or nationalist movement in 20 countries, and the list goes on about the grievous and egregious acts of subversion and outright inhumanity that you say the United States has committed. Why is it, in the face of an international criminal court, in the face of a United Nations, in the face of all these human rights watch type groups, why is it that the polemic still prevails that the United States is actually involved in doing its primary purpose, its primary motivation for involvement anywhere is democracy?
Yeah, what democracy? It's the average American citizen believes that we wherever we go, whatever we do, no matter how bad it may look, the fact remains that we do mean well. Our motives are honorable, if not noble, and this is a testament to the American media and the American education system to have created a society of citizens which have such fallacious beliefs. If one could measure brainwashing as the gap between what a people believe about their country and what the actual facts are, by that measurement, the American people are easily the most brainwashed people in the world. The myths that are in their head about what we do are just without end, and that's one of the main motivations for my writing. Is to deal with these myths, to expose them.
Could we go from the present for a minute, and then we'll go backwards? Could we talk about, in illustrating that point that I just made, the case of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela? What was the United States' involvement in Venezuela in recent years?
Well, there probably has not been any leader in the world more hated by the powers that be in the U.S. than Hugo Chavez. He was more hated than Fidel Castro or Salvador Allende or anyone you can name. He was very unique in his criticism of U.S. foreign policy. He spoke out much more than any leader ever. There's no leader in the world which has criticized U.S. foreign policy the way Chavez did. He spared no criticism of them. And any forum he could be on, he would use this opportunity. At the U.N., we all remember that famous speech at the U.N. where he compared George W. Bush to the devil. I mean, it was just very amazing and unique. Foreign leaders are not supposed to say such things, even if they think them. And Chavez always said what he thought. And so there's no wonder that he became the most hated foreign leader that U.S. has ever had, and which is why in my current anti-empire report, I suggest that his death was not any accident, that he was murdered by the U.S.
Could you walk us through some of the interventions that the United States undertook to undermine the possibility of him coming to power, and once there, the possibility of him retaining power?
He's speaking of Chavez.
Yes.
Well, they didn't do anything to keep him from coming to power, but he was sort of an unknown quantity then. But once he was in power and he made his worldview clear. In fact, I mean, he may not have had it before. It may have evolved with him. In 2002, which is 4 years after he took power, the U.S. backed a coup to overthrow him, and the coup was successful for a couple of days, but then he was ousted by a military force, and then replaced by a new civilian government. But the protests in the public in Venezuela, plus certain elements of the military who were still loyal to Chavez, they combined to force a cancellation of this coup. It was a remarkable event. 2 days after he was overthrown, he was back in power, and it was very clear who was behind that. What I remember when I first wrote about that, and I was asked how I knew that the U.S. was behind the overthrow of Chavez. I said, I know it for the same reason that I know that the sun will rise tomorrow morning. That's what it's always done. And in the case of people like Chavez, this is what the U.S. has always done. There's no reason to think for a moment that this was any different. And there's more evidence than that, of course, but I've written about that. But that was the first attempt to overthrow him. And then after that, there was no, nothing quite as blatant, but except much propaganda. The American media, as always, took its cue from the State Department and the White House. You'd be hard pressed to find any example of a chosen enemy of the U.S. foreign policy where the American media did not follow suit. They are not at all independent, which is very ironic because one of the criticisms that they make against, or they made against Chavez, is that he repressed the Venezuelan media. And to that I say, Venezuela has something which the United States does not have, and that is an opposition media. There is no opposition media in the U.S. And if anyone who doubts that, let them answer this question. There are about 1,400 daily newspapers in the U.S. Can anyone name any paper, any of those 1,400, which unequivocally opposed the invasion of Iraq? I've asked that question in person and in print many times over the years. I've gotten one answer from somebody who said that they believe that the Seattle Post-Intelligencer unequivocally opposed the invasion of Iraq. I haven't been able to verify that, but assuming that's correct, that's one out of 1,400. And the same question would apply to the invasion of Afghanistan. How many newspapers, or not the newspapers, but the TV networks, how many of those networks and newspapers oppose the invasion of Iraq or Afghanistan? Or I could name a dozen other invasions, you know, which the media just supports them without question. Now, what kind of free press is this? And yet we had the nerve to accuse Chavez of suppressing the opposition media in Venezuela.
I want to follow up, though. You dropped a bomb, and I don't want you to walk away without going into some detail about it, and that is that your suspicion that Chavez, in fact, did not die a, quote, natural death, unquote. In fact, it echoes the sentiments of President Maldonado and others in Venezuela who believe that Chavez's death was, how should I say, introduced to him.
Yeah, it's the sequence of events and his ailment are remarkable. First, he had cancer, and where he underwent numerous chemotherapy and other treatments to no avail, and then he had infections of his lungs, which would not go away, and he was getting, of course, the best of treatment. Cuba has an advanced medical system. And then after the infections, then came a heart attack. This is an odd combination. I'm sure it's happened before in the history of the world, but it still seems odd to me. And that sequence of events, plus the fact that the CIA has attempted to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders, it makes it fairly logical for me to come to the conclusion or to the great suspicion that Hugo Chavez did not die a natural death.
I want to shift now to another name in the news in terms of the U.S. Focus on it, and that part of the world is Iran, and the focus is on President Ahmadinejad. In your book, you call him a designer monster. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. The United States, the people in power here, always need to have enemies. Without an enemy, they are a nation without a purpose. They must always be fighting some evil around the world. And if it's not communism, it'll be drug lords, and or else it's going to be terrorists. And Ahmadinejad fit into that need very well. Because he said some things which were not very, very bright, and but what was made up about him was even worse. Though the American media just jumped in and publicized all these myths. One that he was a Holocaust denier, which is total fabrication. And I quote in my book, where he says explicitly that he does not deny the Holocaust, but that he said it at Columbia University in New York City, you know, but that's ignored. And then one of the other myths is that he had called for violence against Israel to overthrow Israel, and that is also a myth, and that's more complex. But I go into the details in my book about that as well. And then he held a conference in Iran some years ago. To study the Holocaust, this was labeled by the American media as a Holocaust denial conference, and that was also very false, and I go into that. So I list amongst a number of the myths about him which have been created by the American media and the U.S. State Department, and I show how they're false.
Speaking of the U.S. State Department, you used to work there.
Yeah.
What made you not work there anymore?
No, that's a long time ago. I was I left in 1967. I had planned to be a Foreign Service officer. I was very anxious to join the great war against the international communist conspiracy. And I was working there as a computer programmer, just biding my time until I could take the Foreign Service exam. And then something came along which changed my mind and my life completely. It was a thing called Vietnam. The war just changed me completely. And I was never the same person again. And I fairly soon lost my ambition to be a Foreign Service officer.
I want to draw the public's attention to the fact that we are discussing America's deadliest export, democracy, the truth about U.S. foreign policy and everything else. The author is with us today, William Blum, and he's also the author of two extraordinary books. Now, those I know, those were, those kind of caused quite a bit of buzz. Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, and Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower. Bill Blum also publishes on the Internet the Anti-Empire report. I was drawn to Chapter 21, Bill, in your book, and I read it very carefully. Chapter 21 deals with our current president, Barack Obama, and you had some intelligence questions. You had some inferences that there are some unanswered questions about our president and perhaps his connection with the intelligence community. Could you talk about that a bit?
I discussed both Obama and his mother. His mother worked for no less than five organizations which had ties to the CIA. Now, that it's hard to be a coincidence. Five such organizations. And Obama himself worked for one, at least one organization which had close ties to the intelligence community as before he became a senator. So putting that together, I'm just asking the question, you know, what does this mean? Can it be just a coincidence? And there's more than that in my book. But I'm raising questions about their ties. It's possible that Obama was groomed to be president of the United States when he was in his 20s by powerful men looking for a bright young black person who could really improve the image of America and would not give them too many problems, and he fit that bill. He has never been a person who questioned authority very much. He was never a skeptic, and I as I say in the book in that section, he doesn't really have a core. So it seems to me, and to other people, there is no core Barack Obama. He is whatever he wants to be for the occasion. Whatever people will see in him, he's. There's even a story of a girlfriend he had for a long time in Chicago, who said the same thing about him. She never, after 2 years with him or so, she never knew who he was or what he really believed. And it's the same today as president. I don't think there's anything that he feels too strongly about. He's willing to compromise on anything at all, as long as he can remain in power. He enjoys being president of the U.S. That's the one thing I can say about him. And he's really a hollow person. He himself admits that in his book, one of his books, he says that people painted on him whatever they wanted to see. That he was aware of this. That he was not offering a real person to them, and so people just made him what they wanted to see in him.
I played a clip a little bit more than a week ago of President Obama. He was then candidate Obama speaking about how his parents came together, and it was a logistical nightmare. He tried to stitch the crossing of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the walk from Selma to Montgomery, as the environment in which his African Kenyan father met his European mother, European American mother. But of course, by the time he was talking about it, he would have already been 4 years old and living outside of the United States at the time, although he painted it as a kind of a romantic link, because the activities of the 60s basically broke down some racial barriers, and the implication was that that's how this interracial marriage occurred. So we caught him there on a logistical problem. But what was isn't it possible that in the 60s his mother had a profound sense of obligation, or a profound sense of justice, and involved herself in these kinds of activities? Why are you raising questions about where the mother worked?
Because these places had close ties to the CIA, one after the other. And I find it hard to view that as a coincidence. I think five examples in my book.
Yes,
how many people do you know have worked for five organizations which had ties to the CIA? It's really weird, isn't it, to say the least.
What do people do in a scenario where we are told you know, the American public is told that we are living in a country where basically, because we have a democratic system, we have access to the throttle and brake of government, we can regulate the speed at which it goes, we could tell it to stop and it will stop, we could tell it to go and it will go, it listens to us, it does our will. We know differently, of course, but in light of our recent experiences, where the power equation is so lopsided that it is questionable whether people can do anything. You, in your book, basically make a point that there's no need to despair. It's not a pretty picture, but why should we not despair?
Oh, I don't say we should not despair. It's pretty despairing. But my only solution, my only advice is education. Educate yourself and as many other people as you can. No attempt at any kind of violent revolution is going to succeed. The people in charge of this country have a better arm than we will ever be, and they will not hesitate to use those arms against us. So that's why, for lack of anything better to offer, I offer education. On the hope or on the premise that if our numbers reach a certain critical mass, there will be some kind of explosion. And I cannot predict the exact form that explosion will take, but that's all I can offer or hope for as a solution to the current situation. For many people, what I offer is not very encouraging, but that's... I don't blame them for feeling that way, but that's not my fault. This is a very powerful empire, and they're not going to be easily changed or toppled.
I want to talk, before we take a break and take questions, at 888-874-4888. Could you talk a bit about the business of foreign policy itself? The president, of course, will be going to, I suppose, he is expected to make some kind of appeasement in Israel. He is going to be called upon to make an even firmer commitment, not only to military support for Israel, and I just looked today and saw that a group, the Democratic Jewish Committee, has said that President Obama has provided Israel with the largest amount of military aid in U.S. history. But apart from that, I think Benjamin Netanyahu wants more, and it seems as if the push is on to have the United States initiate a war with Iran. It looks like it's picking up steam. Do you sense that?
Well, we've heard this talk for a few years now. I mean, how many times has it been announced that war with Iran is imminent, either from Israel or from the U.S. or from both? I mean, it's happened so many times and for so long that I cannot take it too seriously at the moment. If it happens, it'll happen, but I hope it doesn't, because the world does not need another mass bombing. We have enough horror and death and suffering as it is. We don't need another war. We don't need another Iraq or Afghanistan. But that's just my humble opinion, and it has no effect upon our leaders. They don't think in such terms. They think in terms of strategy, and they don't care about the moral question. They don't care about the suffering. That may sound very harsh, but they're not like you and I. They just don't care about the suffering. They think only in terms of political achievement.
America's deadliest export, democracy. The truth about U.S. foreign policy and everything else. Our guest, William Blum, will be back with you very shortly at 888-874-4888. After this break, for your questions, please be sure you have a question when we come back. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. We are honored today to have as our guest William Blum. The author, his newest book is America's Deadliest Export Democracy, The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else, which has served as the basis for our discussion today. But feel free to get the backup books before that came before this, Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II, and Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower. And of course, check his website for the Anti-Empire Report. It's extraordinary. And that's one thing I would like to say, Bill. In reading your book, I mean, it's a very serious subject and you go into great detail. You offer lots of facts and figures and precise information and dates and so forth. But you write with an extraordinary tongue-in-cheek humor. And it helped, I mean, it's incredible, but it helped a lot to bring us along in reading the book. So I want to thank you for that. I chuckled at your headlines. You have extraordinary ability to write very, very catchy headlines.
That's my Brooklyn Jewish upbringing. It is. I was raised in an environment where you made jokes all the time, and we all became very practiced at it. But many of America's most famous comedians were Brooklyn Jews, and so that's where I come from. So I could not write just serious stuff. I'd have to interject the humor. Besides which, I'm writing about stuff which is so sad and so horrible that even for my sake and for the sake of my readers, I have to throw in something light.
Well, it helped. I mean, in a very practical way, because I do edit books, but in a very practical way, it just, you know, encouraged you to keep going because you wanted to get the combination, the seriousness of the subject and the way you introduced it. But we have Michael from New Jersey. You're on the air with William Blum.
Patrice, it's a pleasure. I'd like to ask Mr. Blum a question concerning 9/11, what his view is of 9/11, the fiasco of America, inability to protect people in New York City, and also the folly and the aftermath and the lead up. What is your opinion about what did they get out of it, the whole thing? Was it just to enrich the military industrial contractors, Dick Cheney and his company, et cetera? Or was there some kind of a political strategy concerning the Middle East and our position there? I was wondering what your view is. And in fact, was it a false flag operation from your point of view?
Well, whatever the instigation or the cause of 9/11 was, the how it's been used is very clear. The U.S. has used it to justify invading and bombing all over the world, to expand the empire, to punish anybody they wanted to punish. That's how it's been used. And so that's one reason why so many people think that the U.S. government was actually behind the attacks of 9/11. It was an inside job, as they call it. Now, I have no doubt that the U.S. powers that be were morally depraved enough to do a thing like that. But what happened is so complex and so amazing. I mean, to kill more than 3,000 of your own people, you would have to have a scheme to cover up your involvement, a scheme that's very, very elaborate. And I'm still waiting to hear someone describe exactly what happened. I know the official story is full of holes. I'm fairly well read on that, and I've seen the movies. I know there are all kinds of holes in the official story, but for me to accept that it was an inside job, I'm still waiting to hear what did happen. What happened actually to those four planes? Who piloted them? Who shot them down? Why did they crash? What happened to all the passengers? I have to know those details before I can fully accept the idea that it was an inside job.
Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
Bill, I want to just ask, there was one thing that I read that was quite moving. I mean, it was the picture behind it was certainly quite poignant. And it is on April the 6th, 2011. And you're right, I just want to read this for your comment. In the midst of NATO-US bombing of his country, Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi wrote a letter to President Barack Obama in which he said, quote, "We have been hurt more morally than physically because of what had happened against us in both deeds and words by you. Despite all this, you will always remain our son, whatever happens. Our dear son, Excellency Barack Hussein Abu Obama, your intervention in the name of the USA is a must, so that NATO would withdraw finally from the Libyan affair." How did that turn out?
Well, Gaddafi's letter was ignored by the White House, as have all similar letters from world leaders over the years. I have a section on that, how leaders of countries being attacked by the U.S. have appealed to the White House to stop it and to explain why they're doing it, and they've all been ignored, going back to Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam. And so with Gaddafi, he was also ignored. The American people think of him only in negative terms, and he certainly had a very bad side to him, Gaddafi. He had no patience with anyone in his nation that was in dissent with the policies of the government. But he had a very progressive side as well, which is you never hear about. He gave Libya, the people of Libya, the highest standard of living in all of Africa. He did all kinds of things for the continent of Africa. He helped organize the African Union, I can name many things. That he was a progressive person, and now this society that he created is in shambles. We just wiped it out. There were two countries in Africa, which were in the Middle East, which were advanced and secular and educated and so on, and the U.S. wiped them both out, Iraq and Libya. And this is really a crime which is you never hear spoken of. You know, these are just bad guys, Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, just bad guys, and we gave them what they deserve, and that's the end of the discussion.
And I just want to ask this one thing. I forgot to really introduce it earlier. 888-874-4888. Benghazi.
Oh.
What was that, in fact, as it has been alleged, was the so-called consulate in Benghazi, in fact, a transshipment point for weapons coming from Libya to be funneled to Syria?
You mean at the time of the assassination of the ambassador?
Yes.
I mean, that's what it's become now. You know, your question leads into a very important issue, which is hardly ever discussed. The U.S. support for terrorists. The U.S. government, believe it or not, has fought on the same side as Al-Qaeda type terrorists on five occasions, beginning with Afghanistan in the 1980s, and then going into Bosnia and Kosovo, and then Libya, and now Syria. That's five wars where the U.S. has fought on the same side as Al-Qaeda. And yet we're taught every day of the week that we're engaged in a war against terror. It's an amazing contradiction.
has the question about Benghazi been answered in your view? Do we know what
exactly
that was?
I mean, I've never understood why the Republicans are so upset about what happened there. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
I've never understood. I don't think they really care. I think that it's just a political issue they've used. I don't understand what bothers them about it. I mean, apart from the assassination per se, what is the failure of the U.S. government in this regard that they're harping about? Can you explain that to me?
Well, the question was, did they know? Did they not know? When did they know? What did they do when they found out whatever it is they knew? And why would they not explain who survived? Where are they? What did they do with the people who allegedly survived the attack? Was it in fact a diplomatic compound, or was it in the business of basically gathering arms in order to ship them out to support the opposition or the rebels against
If they were doing that, then why would they be attacked by the same kind of rebels? That doesn't make too much sense to me. We were told again and again that the ones killed in Benghazi were the ambassador and three other Americans. It's an odd way to put it. And it's obvious by now that these three other Americans were CIA people. That's why it's expressed the way it is. But I don't understand what the big issue is. I mean, if the State Department was not maintaining enough security, that's an important question for Congress to be discussing, but it's not something which I deal with.
Thank you. 888-874-4888. What is your current issue? What is the lead story in the current issue of Anti-Empire Report?
Well, the one which came out a week ago dealt with the death of Chavez, which we've discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And it deals also with a statement made by the Department of Justice at a trial in New Orleans of the oil company BP. And this trial is being held to determine what liability BP has for all the deaths and the devastation of the area. And the government attorney, in his opening remarks to the jury, said the BP put profits ahead of people. It put safety, it put profits ahead of safety, and it put profits ahead of the environment. I found that to be a remarkable statement. It's not something you normally hear coming from a government attorney. He's in effect damning capitalism. That what he described is a definition of capitalism, and it's a reason why people like myself are socialists. If my socialism is defined as simply as possible as putting people before profits, and here we have the government attorney in effect seconding that thought. So that I was the subject of one of my other pieces in my report this month.
Oh, good. I didn't mention, and we didn't, I know I wanted to leave some time for calls, but could you comment a bit about how you assess the U.S. position with respect to Cuba?
Well, it never changes. It's the same. It's been the same for decades and decades. And it's amazing that Cuba has survived as long as it has and done so well. But now we're concerned about this man, Alan Gross, who's being held by the Cubans. And he could easily be released. He could be released in 5 minutes if the U.S. would agree to release one or more of the so-called Cuban Five. Five Cubans who have been held in American prisons since 1998, charged with made-up offenses. They came here to fight terrorism, the terrorism carried out by the Cuban exiles in Florida for years and years. They were here to investigate those Cuban exiles and in an attempt to stem the terrorist acts against Cuba by them. So they're fighting terrorism, and what happens? The American government arrests them. Another reason to suspect the motivation of the war on terror, to add to what I said a few minutes ago.
Orville from New York is on. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for the program, Mr. Blum.
Yes.
I wanted to ask, because you said that you see any type of violence as ridiculous, and I also feel the same way. It would be maybe an expression of dissatisfaction, but what would it actually create in terms of what it's supposed to? And you mentioned just now that you are a socialist.
Yes.
And you also mentioned that what you do is to provide information, education to the public where a critical mass can happen that can actually transform it.
Uh-huh.
So given all of that, do you see anything going on in the country that people can actually do once they reach a certain type of critical mass in their personal thinking or their group? Where they can actually, because you can have socialist communities, I believe, anywhere, even within a capitalist society, where people are very frugal, where people can actually raise their standard of living by a more utilitarian existence. Do you see any of that? Do you propose anything like that?
My socialism has a national point of view. It's not really focused on small communities. I think of a socialist society. It's to make full use of the raw materials and everything else that you need in it for a modern society. You're not going to have a small community building cars or airplanes. You need a manufacturing base for a modern society, and that's you need a national program which encourages and finances all sorts of activity. I have no objection to people getting together on a much smaller level
in the interim till that critical mass occurs.
We may be really, really short on time. So I thank you, Orville, for your question. And I want to thank you, Bill, for being with us today. This was an eye-opener. I recommend that people get a copy of the book. It is, again, titled America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, The Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. And certainly check out Anti-Empire Reports, which is the online newsletter that Bill Blum publishes. I couldn't say that fast enough.
Can I mention my website?
Hello? Sure, go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, it's William Blum, that's BLUM, .org.
William Blum. ORG. Well, I want to thank you again for being with us today. It was certainly an extraordinarily enlightening session.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed it.
Thanks. Thank you. So that brings us to the end of our program today. You want to stay tuned. Coming up next is, let's see what's coming up next. I always make a note of it. It's Richard Wolff and Economic Update, I believe. So you want to stay tuned for that. Continue the conversation with me. Always feel free to do that by dropping me a line at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories at gmail.com, or on Facebook at facebook.com/leadstories. I really and truly appreciate your help. And I want to make a plea that we grow this audience exponentially by this week is our Grow the Audience Week. I would like each of you listening to the program to tell at least 10 other people you know. If they can't listen live, they certainly can download a podcast of the show at any time. They go to the archives and they can locate the shows there. So I want to grow it. I'm watching to see the growth of the program, and it will be on the strength of your recommendation to others. Thank you. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.